This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to tonight's show. And for the first show in a while, this is a live show here on WVBR. So if you want to pop into our chat room at wheredidtheroadgo.com, you can do so and throw out some comments and questions if you have any. Also on the website, new, I put a forum up. So if you want to discuss
the opinions expressed by the
topics, if you want to discuss any of the topics on the show, you can go there and do that. We also created a group on Facebook. So that's also somewhere where you can discuss some of this stuff if you're interested. And, of course, you can also become a Patreon for just $3 and get some extra stuff here and there and help support the show. Tonight, we're talking with Robert Sullivan. You're with us there, Rob.
Yeah, I can hear you. Hello. Thank you for having me on Where Did the Road Go? Much appreciated. Great to be back with you.
Yes. The last time we had you on, we were talking cinema symbolism. Which is actually your most recent book. Now we're going to go back a book to your first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism.
And yeah, that's right. Oh, go on, I'm sorry.
When did this come out?
Yeah, this one, that was my first book. That was released in August of 2012.
Okay, and this kind of led to the whole cinema symbolism thing in the long run.
Absolutely. Just real quick, the final chapter... we can get into it if you want, but the final chapter of Royal Arch of Enoch delved into Masonic and some solar hidden symbolisms in movies, and it was a theme I wanted to talk about. It that final chapter is what really spawned cinema symbolism and the book I'm writing right now, which is Cinema Symbolism 2.
All right. So what is the Royal Arch of Enoch?
Yeah, sure. It is a part of the high degree system of Freemasonry. It is not part of Blue Lodge Freemasonry. When we talk Blue Lodge, we are talking the first 3 degrees of Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master Mason. The Royal Arch ritual comes later, and it may not come at all if you do not join the high degree, you know, one of the two main high degree bodies of the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. You know, and those two bodies are completely voluntary. It's up to you. But if you do decide to join either one of those, or both of them, you will encounter the Royal Arch of Enoch ritual. It is the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite. It is the 7th degree in the York Rite. And it really is... when you get into, you know, what's going on in the lodge, in the Blue Lodge, and what's going on in this ritual, it's really one of the most, if not, I would argue, the most important degrees of all Freemasonry.
Okay, and what does this have to do with Enoch?
Yeah, this is really the thesis of the book, The Royal Arch of Enoch, is the ritual, it ties into Enoch. It ties into the Book of Enoch. Comparatively, it has to do with the candidate beholding the Tetragrammaton as an emanation of the name of God. This occurs in the Book of Enoch. A lot of the underlying philosophy of the ritual delves into the restoration of the two pillars of Enoch, and this is the wisdom that he gleans from his journey in the afterlife. You have an entire idea of the candidate by beholding the name of God becoming a Enochian sort of undergoing apotheosis and becoming an Enochian figure. And the thesis of the Royal Arch of Enoch book was when this ritual was being cultivated in France in the 1740s, 1750s, the Book of Enoch, one Enoch, was officially lost to history. It didn't exist to Western civilization. It's not until it essentially really disappears from the 2nd-3rd century to around 1773, I want to say, when a man named James Bruce returns to Europe with 3 copies from Ethiopia. He keeps one of them. He sends one to a library in France. And the other copy is deposited in the basement of the Bodleian Library at Oxford University, where until 1821 it remains untranslated. Yet, the thesis of the book was that the high degree ritual is incorporating components of the lost Book of Enoch, ergo there must have been a lost copy floating around Europe somewhere, because it really does parallel a lot of the teachings and symbolisms going on inside the Book of Enoch. And this is the thesis of the Royal Arch of Enoch book. And again, why it's so important is it's a lot of the symbolism and philosophy that's coming out of this ritual is really being used to help define like the United States of America. So it really is an important ritual within Freemasonry, both in the Blue Lodge and the High Degree system.
Okay, all right. And these degrees are different depending on which. Like the Scottish Rite and the American or York Rite are completely different in most respects, or no?
Well, there are differences between the two rites. The ritual does mirror each other. You know, it is by and large the same ritual. There are variants with it, of course, and this is across the board. Even when you get into like in Ireland and France and Germany, there are slight variants with the ritual. But by and large, the rituals do mirror each other in the York and Scottish Rite. The whole underlying premise of this ritual, what the ritual is documenting, is what is lost in the Blue Lodge in the third degree. In the third degree of the Blue Lodge, this is the Master Mason degree, the candidate portrays this character known as Hiram Abiff, who is the architect of Solomon's Temple. He possesses something called it's called the Word of a Master Mason. It becomes lost in the Blue Lodge. You hear this, if you're familiar with Freemasonry and you do any research in this, you will constantly hear this term, the lost word of a Master Mason. And this is the word that is lost when Hiram Abiff is killed in the Blue Lodge ritual. The word that he possesses is the secret name of God, and the word is recovered. It goes missing in the Blue Lodge. This is what the Blue Lodge Freemasons are always constantly running around looking for, the lost word of a Master Mason. If you join the high degree bodies, the word is recovered in this Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial. In a nutshell, the word is stored in this subterranean vault beneath the holy ground in Jerusalem, beneath the Temple Mount. This word is kept in this subterranean treasure vault, in the ceremonial, the word is recovered during the construction of the Second Temple, it's really, you know, you're finding what is lost in the Blue Lodge. That's one of the reasons why the ritual is so important. But in a nutshell, the two rituals definitely mirror each other.
Now, was that also what the Templars were looking for when they were digging that area?
Oh, well, this is a great question, and you know, we don't know for certain if this is what they were looking for, but this again ties into it, at least in my opinion, and I talk about this in the book, as to why this ritual is just so important. Is the ritual is coming out of Paris, France, in the 1740s, 1750s, as part of the high degree bodies. And one of the ritual as it exists today, the subterranean treasure vault is discovered by Jewish temple builders. But if you go back in time when this ritual is being cultivated, one of the earlier workings of it, one of the very first workings of it, it's called the Scotch Master's degree. And it's from this term Scotch Master, which is where the Scottish Rite most likely takes its name from. The Scottish Rite degrees are French in origin. They're not from Scotland. At any rate, during this Scotch Master's degree, the subterranean treasure vault is actually penetrated by Knights Templar, Scottish Knights Templar, who dedicate the treasure vault to James VI, King of Scotland. If you really start to research this and you backpedal a lot, you begin to ask yourself, is this ritual actually trying to convey some lost yet legitimate history? That this could be, or is at least mirroring some sort of lost history of the Templars discovering a real treasure vault beneath the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem. That's very, very possible. Before I wrote the book, when I was researching this, this seemed more fantasy than reality. But when you research it and you really start to pick this apart, and then you really come to understand the significance of this ritual, you begin to more and more become convinced, at least I was, that this ritual could be documenting, some sort of lost yet legitimate history that we are not aware of.
And what was supposed to be in the treasure vault?
In the ritual, in the ritual as it stands, and again, this is where we get into some varying interpretations of the ritual. It's the name of God. This is what is called the Tetragrammaton. It's the name of God, through the correct pronunciation of this word, the candidate is able to become godlike and restore this wisdom on the two pillars of Enoch. One pillar contains the mathematical wisdom. The other pillar contains the seven liberal arts and sciences. So the name of God is in the treasure vault. In the Scottish Rite system, the name of God is on the foundation stone. In the York Rite, the name of God is on the Ark of the Covenant, and that's, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, at least in some philosophical teachings. Another thing that's in the treasure vault is the Pillars of Enoch. But by and large, the main treasure of the treasure vault is the name of God, the Tetragrammaton. And again, this is what is lost in the Blue Lodge. This is the lost word of a master mason. This is the word that Hiram Abiff is ultimately killed over in the Blue Lodge ritual.
Now, obviously, this is a transmission of information being kept down through the centuries. How old do you think some of this stuff is? Do you think it goes back even further to, like, lost civilizations, or is this just more contemporary ancient knowledge?
Well, that's a great question. The name, I will say this, the name of God in the ritual, I mean, this is no Mason believes this is the real name of God. This is used for ceremonial purposes, as it is in the ritual today. Whether or not, you know, and again, this ties into the whole notion of whether that this is some legitimate history to this, you know, this is certainly debatable. You know, and could this have been with what the Templars found, you know, in Jerusalem? Again, we're speculating here, but it's possible. But the whole idea behind this is, you know, I don't know if I go so far as to say lost civilization. I guess it sort of is. But what you're dealing with is, and why this is so controversial, and this ties into really a lot of anti-Masonic sentiments that are out there, is that the wisdom that is restored by correctly pronouncing this name, this information on the two pillars of Enoch, like I said, the one pillar is the mathematical wisdom, the other pillar is the seven liberal arts and sciences. This is wisdom that Enoch learned. This is what's documented in the Book of Enoch. This is the information that Enoch learns from interacting and hanging around with, for lack of a better term, these watcher demons in the Book of Enoch. These are fallen angels. They're called the Watchers. These are the angels that came down to Earth, mated with the human women to produce the Nephilim in the Book of Genesis. Why this is so controversial is this is where this wisdom is coming from. Enoch gets it. He comes back to Earth, and he catches wind that the flood of Noah is coming. And of course, you know, this is the flood that's going to wipe out mankind so that God can start over. Well, Enoch, in the Masonic literature, and this is in the philosophy of the ritual, Enoch learns that this flood is coming, so he builds this subterranean treasure vault to preserve this wisdom for future generations, despite the fact that this is wisdom and information that God is trying to erase. So what this is really saying is, that with the flood of Noah, Enoch essentially is tricking God by preserving this wisdom. The subterranean vault is created. The flood of Noah comes. The wisdom survives. So what does that mean? It makes Freemasons the preservers of this wisdom that God was trying to eradicate with the flood of Noah. So it's basically the preservation of forbidden wisdom. By and large, which is ultimately the mathematical knowledge and the seven liberal arts. But this, again, can get Freemasons into trouble because it's the preservation of wisdom that God of the Old Testament was trying to eradicate with the flood of Noah.
Hmm. Okay. All right. And, of course, there are people who will say the Anunnaki were left over from a previous civilization or that they're aliens or so on and so forth as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that's another interpretation as well, is that the Enoch being taken up into the heavens and interacting with these watcher demons and archangels, you know, that this is not, you know, these are not demons and angels. These are different races of extraterrestrials. And the wisdom he's bringing back is extraterrestrial nature. I am familiar with it. That is completely up. That's really a more of a subjective interpretation if a person wants to believe that. But I am aware of it.
I always like the idea of the Anunnaki being the race of the survivors of whatever happened at the end of the last ice age, basically.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's one way of looking at it. You know, and again, it does tie into sort of lost civilizations, but it's really more of the idea of lost wisdom, but it's legitimate wisdom and information that Enoch is preserving for future generations. And again, this is ultimately what is recovered in this Royal Arch of Enoch. I mean, the ritual is named after the guy. I mean, it's called the Royal Arch of Enoch. I mean, there's your dead giveaway to this. You know, it's really is when you break it down and you read the book, you will come to understand why this ritual is so important within Freemasonry, you know, in the entire degree system. I mean, it really is. A lot of people aren't aware of this. I'll just get into this really, really quick. That there is, you will constantly hear, and this is. You know, this idea of, okay, you know, within this, let's just take the Scottish Rite, for example. You know, the higher up the degrees you move, the more information that's passed along and this and that, and you reach the 33rd, and you're in this Illuminati group and whatever. This really isn't the case. The degree structure, believe it or not, of the Scottish Rite and the York Rite is the same way to by and large, is somewhat out of order. You enter the Scottish Rite and then you go through what's called the Lodge of Perfection, which ends in this Royal Arch of Enoch ritual, and that's exactly why it's called the Lodge of Perfection, is because the idea is by possessing this name of God, you are perfected. In the York Rite, they call this exaltation. It's exactly the same thing. But then after this ritual is over with, you go to the 14th degree, which is really more honorary and ceremonial. But then when you get into the 15th, 16th, and these degrees going up to the 32nd, a lot of them take place prior to the Royal Arch ceremony. You actually go back in time. And some of them are very short. So really within the Scottish Rite, I mean, and it's kind of the same way for the York Rite. I mean, this really is sort of the premier degree within all of Freemasonry. Now, I know, you know, numerically it is not. Numerically it's not the highest degree, and certainly the 33rd really technically is the highest degree. But really, when you're getting into this whole idea of importance and philosophy, the Royal Arch of Enoch ritual is sort of the end of the Masonic story. It's the end of the Grail Quest. That's the best way for me to describe it.
Okay. You want to talk a little bit of how this affects, like, the District of Columbia and the foundation of America?
Yeah, sure. We could get into that. Let me just get into a little bit of backstory with this. It helps frame it a little bit.
Sure. No, go ahead.
You have Blue Lodge Freemasonry coming onto the scene. This is degrees 1, 2, and 3 in 1717. You know, this is coming out of England. This becomes very popular. The high degree bodies, the original high degree body is called the Rite of Perfection. This comes out of Paris, France, in the 1740s, 1750s. This is being cultivated by the Society of Jesus, these high degrees, as part of the Counter-Reformation. It's a very long story. I'm not going to belabor this. It's subterfuge to undermine England, to undermine the British monarchy. And the high degree bodies were essentially, when they were originally created, a vehicle to restore a Stuart Catholic back to the throne of England. And it's because of this exact reason that the high degree body never catches on in London. High degree Freemasonry in London and its surrounding environment is not popular. And it's because of who and what it associates with, the two mortal enemies of the English, the Jesuits and the French. Now, the high degrees do become very popular in England, on the continent of Europe. They become very popular in places like Scotland, in Ireland, in Wales, not so much in England by large. And, you know, you fast forward, you know, to Freemasonry. I mean, we know a lot of the founders were part of, of Freemasonry, people like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Daniel Carroll. He is a person from Maryland, which is where I am. He is often left behind. He is very critical to this understanding. You have the revolution, and of course, you know, who was our greatest ally during the revolution? It was France. So, you know, you had this French-American nexus. The high degrees become very popular. They're midwifed into the United States by a man named Etienne Morin. A lodge of perfection is set up in Philadelphia. The main one is set up in Albany, New York. It's this high degree body that spawns the York Rite, which is created by a man named Thomas Smith Webb. The Scottish Rite Supreme Council is established in Charleston, South Carolina in 1801. We get into, after the Revolution, the creation of the United States, and we will see Masonic overtones all over the place, both symbolically in the government and in the architecture. If you want to get into Washington, D.C., we certainly can. We are dealing with a lot of, you know, within Masonry, the entire Blue Lodge structure of Freemasonry is centered around the sun. I mean, for example, we have the Worshipful Master sitting in the east, the Junior Warden sitting in the south, and the Senior Warden sitting in the west. And, of course, this is the three phases of the sun. The sun is the rising sun in the morning in the east, the sun at midday, high meridian in the south at noon, and then, of course, the setting sun at west in the west in the evening. This is the triple division of government in a Blue Lodge, and, of course, this becomes triple. This is why our government is triple divided between a legislature, a judiciary, and a chief executive. You get into this arcana with this. The presidency is modeled after a royal arch sun priest who is sort of the moderator of all Freemasonry. It's somewhat complex, but in the early stages of the country, the royal arch degree was really the pinnacle of all Freemasonry. It was really the highest degree you could reach, and it's because of that. You will find a lot of symbolism. Even within the Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial, we have a lot of solar symbolism going on. The name of God is discovered when the sun rays penetrate the subterranean vault. It's the way I start off the Royal Arch of Enoch book. Really, the most important symbol within all of Freemasonry, both really even in the definitely within the Blue Lodge, but even in the high degrees, is the sun. We fast forward to, the District of Columbia, which is what your question, we have, just right off the bat, we have the Pythagorean right triangle formed by the White House, the Washington Monument, and the United States Capitol. This is A squared plus B squared equals C squared. C squared is the hypotenuse, which is Pennsylvania Avenue. This is also known in Freemasonry as the 47th proposition of Euclid. If you go back to high school, again, you remember this is A squared plus B squared equals C squared. This is the emblem worn by a Masonic worshipful master who represents the rising sun. And of course, we have, it would be formed from the White House down to the Washington Monument, the Washington Monument up to the Capitol. You get into mystical Freemasonry, and you delve into pre-Masonic organizations like the Rosicrucians. This was an Egyptian solar symbol, with the one side representing Osiris, the dead and resurrected sun god, the other side being his virgin consort Isis, the hypotenuse being their perfected solar child Horus. In the United States Capitol, we have Pennsylvania Avenue as the hypotenuse. Hypotenuse connecting the two elected branches of government, the White House and the United States Capitol. Pennsylvania Avenue is, of course, a reference to the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the Keystone State, and we're dealing with a lot of esoteric masonry here. A keystone is what creates an arch, and a keystone is critical within Royal Arch Freemasonry. So we are dealing with a lot of Royal Arch symbolism just with that alone. And, of course, we have solar symbolism with the Washington Monument being an emblem of Horus or Amun-Ra, who is sort of the spiritual force, the spiritual sun god. Then you have the United States Capitol building, the domed building is the chamber of the sun god Apollo, who is, of course, in antiquity, the premier sun god. This comes out of the works of two Renaissance masters named Leon Battista and Andre Palladio. So within in the federal, I mean, then you have, I mean, I could spend hours talking about this. You have the, it's just a real in-depth study with this. You got the whole idea of the domed building sitting on the hill comes from the novella, The City of the Sun by Tomosa Campanella, who documents this new world's capital city. And he says, the first thing you see when you get there is this giant domed building sitting on a hill. And of course, it's called the City of the Sun. So, it's a lot of solar symbolism, a lot of Masonic symbolism going on in Washington, D.C. I get into it much more in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. You get into this, and I'll just get into this briefly. I don't know if you want to go, maybe a question later. You will find this symbology, this symbolism, all over the damn place. We find the solar, Enochian Masonic symbolism here in Baltimore, Maryland. We will find this surrounding the Erie Canal, Union College of Schenectady, New York. It's a very in-depth study, but when you're dealing with a lot of the early construction of the United States, the actual construction, the actual architecture, the men who did it were all Freemasons, and they all turned to Freemasonry as sort of, they didn't want to, after this country was set up and when it was being set up, they knew they didn't want a monarchy. They didn't want a Vatican-style organization. So they really turned to Freemasonry as this symbolic treasure trove to really formulate the country around. And, when you get the eye for this, you will begin to see this literally, quite honestly, all over the place.
Does that still happen now?
That's really a great question, because you can document this up until modern times to a certain extent. A lot of times, some of it's Masonic, some of it is more esoteric. It ties into Freemasonry. It comes from this maxim called "as above, so below." You probably have heard that before.
Sure.
This is inscribed on the emerald tablet of this character known as Hermes Trismegistus. Hermes Trismegistus is a Egyptian god coming out of Hellenistic Egypt. He is a combination of three deities. He is the Roman Mercury, the Greek Hermes, and the Egyptian Thoth. And when combined, you get this wizard figure, the god of magic, called Hermes Trismegistus. Hermes Trismegistus, the last name, Trismegistus means the thrice greatest, with sometimes the greatest of three. He is very important to Freemasonry. In fact, you could call Hermes Trismegistus the godfather of all of Freemasonry. He is responsible, and this ties into the Royal Arch of Enoch, its underlying philosophy. When this subterranean vault is established by Enoch, prior to the Masons discovering it, the vault is penetrated by two people. One is Hermes Trismegistus, who breaks into the vault, finds the name of God, pronounces it correctly, and restores the seven liberal arts and sciences back to mankind. If you have a symbolic eye, you will constantly see Hermes or Mercury or Hermes Trismegistus popping up around a library or in an educational setting. And this is referencing the restoration of the seven liberal arts and sciences back to mankind. The other person who penetrates the vaults is Pythagoras, the mathematician, who pronounces, Eureka, I have found it, meaning the name of God, and restores the mathematical pillar back to mankind. So we get into this whole notion of as above, so below. which is inscribed on the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. This is by and large Freemasonic. Some modern architects are aware of this, just use it to align a building to, you know, whatever. But there seems to be a much deeper meaning to this, especially when you're getting into these really important government buildings. I documented, for example, in the book, and this is modern times, this is 20th century we're talking here. Just a couple examples. The St. Louis Gateway Arch, which is an archway, that this is symbolizing the Royal Arch Ceremonial. It's Masonry's westward expansion. This is actually Kabbalistically and astrologically aligned to the Statue of Liberty in New York. It's a reference to the Erie Canal being linked to the Mississippi Delta. And you'll find this, symbolized in stone with the St. Louis Gateway Arch. Another one, what its exact alignments are, it's very complex. It has to do with when the keystone was put in place, when it was begun and when it was finished. It's a very complex study, but I want to say the halfway delineation point was on June 24th or June 21st, which is the summer solstice, which is when the sun, again, which is a Masonic symbol, is at its strongest in the Northern Hemisphere. Another good one, which is modern day, is the Supreme Court building. Of course, this is up until the 1930s, the United States Supreme Court met in the Capitol building. In the 1930s, the Supreme Court got its own building. The cornerstone of the United States Supreme Court building, this is the one today that sits right behind the Capitol building, was laid on October 13th, I want to say of 1932. The date of October 13th is the sun at its highest delineation, its high watermark in the House of Libra. Libra is, of course, the great astrological scales of justice. So by dropping the cornerstone of the United States Supreme Court building on October 13th, you are astrologically aligning the building to the scales of justice in the sky, the House of Libra. So you will find this going on in modern days, and there definitely seems to be, from what I could tell, this sort of Masonic hand behind it. I don't think it's evil or anything like that. It's just really Masonry, reflecting and echoing these very ancient teachings. It ties into the whole idea of it's a lot of Neoplatonic thought. It comes out of the work of a man named Raymond Lully, who talked about sacred architecture and the alignments. The whole idea behind all this is by doing something like this. I mean, you say, okay, well, so what? The whole symbolic underlying philosophy of all this is by doing this by these astrological alignments, you're investing your building with deity or with a divine presence. I guess that's probably the better word, because the stars, the planets are closer to God in heaven than we are. So by doing this, you're symbolically drawing the stars down to earth, drawing their divine power down to earth, and investing it in your building. That's sort of the motivation behind this.
Now, are the more modern lodges of Freemasonry as connected to this stuff, or have they kind of gone off on their own a little bit?
You know, that's another great question, because what really sort of has happened, what kind of happened was with Freemasonry, I believe that when it was established, it really is incorporated. When it was established in 1717 officially, now I know there were Masonic lodges operating prior to that, it really the best way for me to describe it is sort of like a modern day mystery school. I think that's a very appropriate title for it. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of arcane themes, a lot of Egyptian themes, these ancient mystery schools, Mithraism, the Eleusinian mysteries, Pythagoras, math, sacred geometry, all coming together. Masonry cuts across a lot of boundaries. I mean, it really incorporates a lot of things. It incorporates philosophy, religion, symbolism. That's why it's such a vast study. And I loved writing the book, is because Freemason really, it crosses political paths, it crosses philosophy, it crosses architecture. When you're dealing with Freemasonry, you're dealing with a ton of subject matter. Unfortunately, in the United States, in the 1820s, Masonry had to kind of distance itself from this these arcane teachings. It was going to go out of business. There was a secret cabal working in the government, run by a guy named DeWitt Clinton. And this is where a lot of the conspiracies surrounding Masonry come from. He was a very important high degree Freemason. He was a former mayor of New York, New York City. He's a former governor of the state of New York. He was operating this Masonic high degree cabal within government to formulate policy over state lines. This was uncovered in the 1820s. There was this huge backlash, and Masonry all but went out of business. It survived it by sort of distancing itself from any sort of esoteric tradition. So a lot of the, you know, and this is sort of the philosophy that carried Masonry up through the 19th century, through the 20th century. There still seemed to be this sort of arcane teachings, but Masonry kind of distanced itself from it, at least publicly. But, it really wasn't until, even when I joined, when I petitioned the Lodge in 1996, I was ultimately ritualized in 1997. Any sort of talk about, you know, the architecture of Washington, oh, it's just a coincidence. I mean, you just start researching this stuff objectively, and you'll completely find this is not a coincidence in any way, shape, or form. I think part of the reason why it distanced itself also was it fueled this negative conspiracy theory. But really, when you start peeling back the onion, you'll find it's really not negative at all. And in fact, it's a form of divinity. It really ties into this Renaissance tradition called Christian Kabbalah, which is just a reworking of Hebrew Kabbalah. Where all this is coming out of, to make a long story incredibly short. But to wrap up your question, it really wasn't until the advent of the internet that Masonry has really started to re-embrace its sort of mystical traditions, and with the Dan Brown and the National Treasure stuff, a lot of the millennials, I guess is the proper word, definitely seem to be interested in the more arcane aspects of the craft, as it were.
Are you still an active Freemason now?
Me? Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. I joined in. I joined a lodge here in Baltimore, Maryland, called when I joined it in 1996. I petitioned it in 1996. My application was approved in the autumn of 1996. I went through the Entered Apprentice degree. I couldn't give you the exact dates, but I went through the Entered Apprentice degree in January of 97. I became a Fellow Craft in May of 97, and I became a Master Mason in September of 97. I have always been an active member. My membership is in good standing. When I joined the lodge, it was called Amicable Lodge Number 25. It was the third oldest lodge here in Baltimore, or in the state of Maryland, actually. It has subsequently merged with a couple other lodges, and now it is known as Amicable St. John's Lodge Number 25. But no, I have been in good standing since I joined. I maintain an active membership. All my dues are up to speed. And I'm also a 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite here in Baltimore. I joined that in 1999.
And they don't have any objection to you writing about this stuff?
No, none whatsoever. That's another great, great question to ask. I've been asked this before. Oh, how can a Mason write these books and this and that? If you read other Masonic authors, people like Albert Mackey, Manly P. Hall. The running course with this, the line of Masons writing books about Freemasonry, for starters, you are encouraged to write and investigate Freemasonry and its symbolism. There is no prohibition against that, and certainly a lot of the great books about Freemasonry, and I'd like to include mine, have been written by Freemasons. I mean, certainly the Albert Pike book, Morals and Dogma, some of the works of Manly P. Hall, of course, the great Albert Mackey. So then I get asked, oh, well, you know, you're a Mason, how can you do this? The marching orders from Freemasonry is, if you're talking about Masonic history, its symbolic interpretation, its symbols, its history, the architecture, that's all fair game. If you want to get into the rituals, the sort of line is, this is public record at this point, so you can talk about that. What they don't want you talking about is really twofold, is they don't want you sensationalizing it. I mean, if you could pin down stuff and it's legitimate, that's fine. Even if it is, new information, that's acceptable. They don't want, the whole, Masons are reptilian shapeshifter, sort of line. And, right. And they don't want the passwords. When you join the Blue Lodge, you are given a set of what are called pass tokens, keys, passwords, symbols, tokens, tokens of recognition, they're called, secret words, secret handshakes. This is what they don't want you exposing. You know, this is the way you're supposed to be able to identify one Mason from another. They don't want you talking about that. I don't mention it in the book. Occasionally, if push comes to shove and I have to talk about it, I usually only put the initials down. I never put the whole syllable word down. I just put the initials down. That's fair game. They don't want you really talking about the passwords and tokens. So if you do that, you're okay writing a book. And hence the Royal Arch of Enoch is out. And I can report that the Masons, by and large, who have read it, absolutely love it. I've been invited to speak at Masonic Lodges about the book. So no problem there.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Robert Sullivan.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we've been talking tonight with Robert Sullivan about his first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch. And you still with us there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Yeah,
all right.
Great to be back.
So a lot of people, of course, will connect the Freemasons with the Illuminati. And is there anything in any of the work you've done that suggests to you that there is any kind of Illuminati or any connection to Freemason, or is that just sensationalist type stuff?
Oh, no, absolutely not. There is definitely a connection with the Freemasons and the Illuminati. In fact, I'll get into it. The guy that I mentioned, DeWitt Clinton, this former mayor of New York, I don't know if in your travels you've ever heard the term the Colombian Illuminati. This was the American version of the Illuminati. You know, of course, we had the Bavarian Illuminati.
Right.
The Colombian Illuminati with the American Illuminati. The guy who ran the American Illuminati was DeWitt Clinton. The Colombian Illuminati is an interchangeable word for the Royal Arch Masons in the United States. Mm. Those were the puppet masters back in the day. There is definitely a nexus here. You have the Bavarian Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt coming on the scene in 1776. You know, I've researched the Illuminati. This is of Weishaupt, of Xavier Zwack, and that crowd. From what I can document, this is, again, another product of the Jesuits. You know, Weishaupt was, you know, trained by the Jesuits. You know, you have all the hallmarks of the Jesuits all over the place with this thing. I mean, the cell, counter cell, the Jesuits. I mean, and this is also likely because the Jesuits were suppressed just 3 years earlier in 1773 by the Pope for their, you know, occult machinations and political, you know, monkey shines. You know, the Jesuits had to be put out of business. So then three years later, we have the Jesuits coming back on the scene as the Illuminati. A German aristocrat who was a Freemason joined the Illuminati. His name is Adolf Knigge. He leaves thereafter and he writes a treaty saying, don't fall for this. This is just the Jesuits under another name. All this stuff about, you know, egalitarianism and, you know, radical Freemasonry and you know, anti-religion. This is all total ruse. This is just all the Jesuits under another name. Don't fall for it. But we have in the United States the whole idea of the Illuminati working within government, pulling the strings from behind the scenes. Using Freemasonry as a vehicle for this. You will definitely find this in the early days of the country. What this comes from, how this comes to come into existence is, and you just got to know a little Masonic history here. In Masonry, and this exists this way to this day, there is no one universal Grand Lodge of the United States. Each one of the states has a Grand Lodge, and each one of these Grand Lodges monitors the Blue Lodges in that state. That Grand Lodge is not answerable to anything. I'm here in Maryland, so I'm under the aegis of the, my lodge would be under the aegis of the Grand Lodge of Maryland. But right across the border there in Pennsylvania, you're going to have the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania. The Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania is not answerable to Maryland and vice versa. They operate independently. But this isn't the case with the high degrees. Once you leave the Blue Lodge, the high degrees in the earlier days of the country allowed Masons to operate together over state lines, where you weren't meeting in a Blue Lodge system under the aegis of a state Grand Lodge. You were operating in the high degrees. This is where this whole thing of the high degree bodies being this vehicle of the Illuminati comes from. Is in the early days of this country, the high degree Masons, and again, in the earlier days of the country, the highest degree was the Royal Arch. And what it really ties into was the Royal Arch Masons were operating across state lines to formulate policy. And the guy who was running the show was DeWitt Clinton. DeWitt Clinton hangs around with all the Federalists, Washington, Adams, but he was a Jeffersonian Republican. And what they were trying to do behind closed doors was formulate policy that wasn't divisive, that wasn't going to tear the country apart. He viewed it as unifying the Jeffersonian Republicans with the Federalists. So he viewed it, and he would have argued, oh, this is a positive thing. The problem was it was going on behind closed doors. There was no transparency whatsoever, and this got found out and completely exposed in the 1820s with this incident called the William Morgan Affair. DeWitt Clinton actually dies shortly thereafter. The William Morgan Affair, and this is what blew this whole thing wide open, that there was this secret high-degree Masonic cabal working within government, which was true, and this completely mirrors the machinations of the Bavarian Illuminati. I do not disagree with this in any way, shape, or form. This, by and large, gets wiped out, but again, the rumors persist. And they persist to this day that this organization, this body, still exists, despite the fact that, the credible evidence that this got completely eradicated. So, just to answer your question, there is definitely an Illuminati influence upon Freemasonry. And this is very well documented when it comes to Freemasonry and the foundation of our country. We're dealing with a time frame from probably around the death of Washington, around 1799, to around 1825, 1826, 1827. This is when DeWitt Clinton really takes the reins of Freemasonry after the death of Washington and runs with it, and uses these high degrees as a body to formulate policy in the new country.
Okay, all right. So do you think there's anything going on nowadays, like with the Bohemian Grove and all this type of stuff, that's in any way related anymore?
I don't see any nexus with the Bohemian Grove with Freemasonry. You get into groups like Skull and Bones. A lot of these groups are what I would call Masonic-like. But they're really not tied to Freemasonry. You can even look at like college sororities and fraternities. They have their origins in Freemasonry. The founders of some of the early fraternal systems was a Freemason, a guy named John James Beckley. You get into groups like Skull and Bones. Again, with William Huntington Russell, it's Illuminati-like, it's Masonic-like, but there's really no ties to Freemasonry. Another organization that was very influential at this time, this is one no one's ever heard of. Again, it's a secret society. It's like the Freemasons, but they're not related, called the Odd Fellows. They all but don't exist anymore, but they were incredibly powerful in the early days of the country. At one point they may have even been more powerful than the Freemasons at one point. Bohemian Grove is I want to say a late 19th century invention. The closest thing with Freemasonry I think you can find with Bohemian Grove, and this is I'm just going to go over this quickly because it's a huge backstory. We won't have time for it. Is the giant owl statue at Bohemian Grove? From what I could tell, that has to do with the reason that's there is it ties into Minerva being on the state seal of California, and of course the owl is her sacred totem. Minerva being on the state seal of California is an Enochian emblem. You know, you got the word Eureka on it. This is a reference to Pythagoras and the subterranean vault. And you got the little miner, you know, digging towards the subterranean vault there on the seal. The seal of California is a parody of the seal of the Grand Lodge of the Oddfellows in California. And Minerva is a representation of the sacred wisdom that is contained in the subterranean vault. Minerva reaches that state seal. She comes off of the seal, the crest of Union College of Schenectady, New York, which was the first college established after the Revolution that offered high degrees, quote-unquote, in civil engineering or operative masonry. And the emblem, the symbol of Union College, is Minerva. And the phrase is, we are all brothers under the laws of Minerva. And Minerva there is again, a symbol of this knowledge. She's much like her. She's like a female Hermes Trismegistus, almost, as an emblem of the sacred wisdom. So if you want to get into the owl statue being a representation of Minerva, I really couldn't argue that one. But a lot of these groups that exist today, I would describe them as Masonic-like, although they may not necessarily be tied to Freemasonry.
Okay. All right. Now, Richard Hoagland has made a big deal about how everything NASA does has Freemasonry-type connotations. Do you find that to be accurate?
To a certain extent, one of the guys who was responsible, his name is, it's not Fred Klein Connect, it's his brother, and I forget his name. He was a 33-degree Mason, and you will find Masonic connotations with some of this stuff, with the NASA emblems. The most striking one is Apollo 13, which is the sun being carted across the sky in the chariot. This has to do with Maise Merkheber mysticism. And again, it's a representation of the 13th degree of the Scottish Rite, the 13th degree of the Rite of Perfection, the restoration of wisdom. The logo, the catchphrase for Apollo 13 was from the moon, wisdom. So again, we have this idea of the restoration of wisdom. And again, the sun in the sun chariot is Maise and Merkheber symbolism. This ties into Enochian symbolism. So the Apollo 13 one is really, probably the most striking one of the NASA emblems for Freemasonry. But then you get into the whole idea, and this ties into Rosicrucianism, and the sacred, the idea of the sacred feminine, the divine masculine. And of course, you have the lights of Freemasonry, the sun and the moon. So when you go to the moon, which is what's the moon symbolize? The sacred feminine. The moon is, of course, always been associated with the sacred feminine. So if we're going to have a unification of the sun and moon, we have to name the rockets after the masculine, which is Apollo, the sun god. So the Apollo rocket is, of course, and landing on the moon is the alchemical wedding, the unification of the sun and moon. This is sort of more Rosicrucianism, more ancient mystery school, but it definitely sort of ties into Freemasonry. So, I mean, just the whole idea of the unification of the sun and moon, is alchemical, is sort of Masonic. So you will find that as well. So, no, yeah, I mean, you will find this stuff in places where you may not necessarily expect to find it, and NASA is, and movies is another one, but NASA is one also. You will definitely have a decidedly Masonic influence upon NASA. I think that's pretty well established.
Okay, all right. And I know he just sees it in everything they do, from launch dates to where they go in different landing sites and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, timing. Timing is everything, as they say. And again, you will find this one of the most striking dates of all. It hasn't to do with NASA. It has to do with it has to do with the Washington Monument and being aligned to the Egyptian dog star Sirius. It's an incredibly long story, but it has to do with when they reset the cornerstone. if you look at the Washington Monument, it's a long story. I'll try to condense it. It's very complex. If you take a look at the Washington Monument with your naked eye, just as it is today, you're going to just forget about symbolism or anything. You're going to see something should kind of jump off the picture at you, and that is about a quarter of the way up, the color of the stones change color. The bottom portion is a different color than the top. The reason for this is they started building it. The Civil War broke out, and they stopped construction on it. After the Civil War was over, they restarted construction on it. And it was at this point they reset the cornerstone. They did another ceremony on the cornerstone, and they dropped the cornerstone at 10:59 a.m. And that is such a bizarre time to drop the cornerstone. That 10:59 a.m. is a reference to July 4th, 1776, and it has to do with this ties into the sacred feminine. In the Egyptian mysteries, Isis, the virgin goddess, she possessed also the secret name of God. This is how she was able to resurrect Osiris. And Sirius, Isis plays a symbolic importance in all this. She's sort of like the sacred feminine in Freemasonry. It's a very long story, but that 10:59 date, 10:59, is actually a reference to July 4th, 1776. It's a reference to the founding of the country, the signing of the Declaration of Independence. On July 4th, 1776, the Egyptian dog star Sirius was 10 minutes 59 seconds in the sign of Cancer. So when they reset the Washington Monument, they actually were aligning it to the Egyptian dog star Sirius by dropping the cornerstone at 10:59 in the morning, which is a reference to July 4th, 1776, when Sirius was 10 minutes 59 seconds in the sign of Cancer. That's a great one. I mean, that comes out of the world, and you just can't make this stuff up. And it ties into why the Washington Monument, the sun, E obelisk, is aligned to the Egyptian dog star Sirius. Again, it's the sun and the moon, the masculine and the sacred feminine, which in the Egyptian mysteries was Sirius qua Isis. And Isis, of course, also associates with the moon also. But the 10:59, the rededication of the Washington Monument at 10:59 a.m. is referencing the Egyptian dog star and its place in the sky back on July 4th, 1776.
All right. You're listening to WVBR-FM Ithaca. I also wanted to ask you about the pentagram as a symbol of Sirius and how that figures in.
Well, that is absolutely correct. You're hitting grand slams here tonight. That ties into perfectly with this. The if you read Masonic literature, and again, you have to kind of know something that's going on inside the Blue Lodge. Hiram Abiff is the sun. He's this dead and resurrected sun god. It's a retelling of the Osirian legend with Osiris being killed and resurrected. If you read this correctly, in Freemasonry, in Masonic lodges, you'll find a pentagram. This is what's called the Blazing Star of Freemasonry. The Blazing Star is the Egyptian dog star, Sirius. And of course, Sirius was a representation, of this Egyptian goddess, Isis. Isis in Egyptian lore possessed the secret name of God, Amun-Re. What this secret name was, we don't know. We don't know it to this day. The hieroglyph that talks about this has actually been destroyed. So whatever this name was, we don't know. But in Egyptian lore, and this parallels the Masonic lore, Isis possessed the secret name of Amun-Re, the Egyptian spiritual sun god, and it was through this name she was able to resurrect Osiris, who had been slain by Set, and then sire Horus, who was his solar stand-in. Comparatively, this is the god Apollo, or Helios, and Osiris at that point becomes the solar sort of deity of the dead at that point. This is symbolized in Freemasonry with the pentagram when the candidate, and it's very adroitly concealed, when the candidate is dead as Hiram Abiff. Okay, the candidate portrays Hiram Abiff. He's the sun god. He gets murdered. He gets buried west of the temple, symbolizing the setting sun, symbolizing death. He is resurrected. And when the candidate as Hiram Abiff is resurrected, he is greeted upon what is called the Five Points of Fellowship. the 5 points, of course, are the pentagram. 5 points form the pentagram. And it, and when this pentagram, the symbolic pentagram, is formed, he has a substitute name of God whispered in his ear. I can't say what it is, but it's a substitute name of God. But the whole idea of a name of God being whispered in your ear upon 5 points, the pentagram, Sirius, is referencing this Egyptian lore of Isis, Sirius, possessing the secret name of God, and using it to resurrect Osiris, just as you are brought up upon 5 points, symbolizing Sirius, Isis, and are now resurrected with this name of God whispering in your, being whispered in your ear. So this is very deep lore. This is very deep Masonic symbolism. The name that's whispered in your ear is a substitute name of deity. The real name isn't discovered until the Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial, tying in Enoch with all this Egyptian lore. It's a very interesting study. When you begin to piece this all together, and you read the book, you will understand, you know, this symbolism in the architecture much, much more plainly. It becomes much more visible to the naked eye.
Okay. And of course, you know, obviously people want to link the pentagram with negativity and such.
Well, the way, the, you know, it's like any other symbol in the world. The pentagram, if it's 1 point up and 2 points down, that's white Kabbalistic magic. The pentagram isn't necessarily negative. The pentagram was associated with Pythagoras, the mathematician. The 1 point up, the 4 points down symbolize mash. The other 4 points symbolize earth, air, fire, water. The 1 point up symbolizes ethereal mastery of these elements. It's nothing negative whatsoever. If you take it and reverse it and put the 2 points up and the 1 point down, that's left-hand path Kabbalah, that's dark gnosis, that's the goat of Mendes. That can be negative, but it could also be interpreted positively. If you want to see this practically seen, take a look at the Wizard of Oz movie, Glenda the Good Witch. Her magic wand has the pentagram with 1 point up, 2 points down, symbolizing her as a white magician. And of course, it gets a bad rap because Anton Chandor LaVey, in the mid-1960s, used the pentagram as the emblem for the Church of Satan. But again, I stress this, I constantly am stressing this, just because one group uses a symbol for something doesn't necessarily mean just because another, you know, if a masonry uses a pentagram for something, don't presume for 1 minute that because if the Church of Satan uses it, there's some sort of linkage there. I mean, symbols can be used, you know, unconnected. I mean, look at the Nazi swastika. I mean, that symbol predates the Nazis. I mean, that symbol can be found in Buddhist temples. It can be found in Jewish temples. So don't equate necessarily one group with another just because someone uses a similar symbol. You know, you have to look at, you know, all these groups on their own and why they're using their symbol and what's the motivation behind it.
Now, how did all this stuff work itself in the movies?
Oh, this ties into, you know, when I was doing Royal Arch of Enoch, when I was writing it, as we've been talking about, you know, we're dealing with a lot of very deep, heavy themes, Masonic history, you know, politics, comparative religion, Kabbalah. And I really, really, really wanted to end the Royal Arch of Enoch book by bringing it up to the 21st century. And I figured, what better way to do this than to end the book dealing with a chapter of Masonic symbolism in film, and sort of Enochian solar symbolism in film. And as I was doing this chapter, I was seeing, you know, other themes, ancient religions, ancient symbolisms, archetypes in movies, but they weren't necessarily Masonic per se. I mean, some were, but some weren't. You know, I mean, seeing like the Matrix movies was the Gnostic religion, the monomyth in Star Wars, a lot of comparative religion in Back to the Future movies, And it was, I wanted to talk about those movies, but I couldn't put them in the Royal Arch of Enoch. So I thought, okay, you know, let me just stick to the Masonic stuff for Royal Arch. And really, the two movies that really kind of just jumped off the screen at me when I kind of like had the aha moment that this was, you know, that I wasn't seeing things was the first National Treasure movie and the Da Vinci Code movie. And those movies came out right around each other. The first National Treasure movie, I mean, it has Masonic overtones. I mean, some of it's kind of overt. But if you want to watch the Royal Arch of Enoch ritual on the big screen, I mean, it is the first National Treasure movie. I mean, what's the Royal Arch of Ritual about? It's about the rest of the recovery, the restoration of this Masonic Knights Templar treasure in a subterranean vault beneath the holy ground. Okay, I mean, what's national treasure? I mean, it's follow the solar Masonic clues that lead you to the Masonic Knights Templar treasure vault in a, you know, subterranean treasure vault, you know, beneath the holy ground. And I love the fact that National Treasure had the subterranean vault in New York, of all places, in the heart of New York. I mean, that is a clear reference to DeWitt Clinton and the Royal Arch Masons, who are all based in New York. So, you know, when I was watching this, I was like, my God, I mean, here is a Masonic ritual on the big screen for everyone to see, and no one knows it. So this was what was really motivating me to talk about this. And the Da Vinci Code has it too. We get into and National Treasure too has the same thing in Da Vinci Code. When you're dealing with the Royal Arch Ritual, this is, again, the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite. It's the 13th degree in the original Rite of Perfection. And, again, part of the underlying theme is the restoration of wisdom, the restoration of all knowledge. If you pay attention to the Da Vinci Code movie, every time wisdom or information or knowledge is needed, the number 13 will pop up on the screen. I mean, the Mona Lisa, where the one clue is kept, is in Hall 13. You will find this in the second National Treasure movie when they desperately need information on the Resolute desk in the White House. Riley says, oh, turn to chapter 13. It's in chapter 13. So we will find this. So this was really what was motivating me was to talk about some of these Masonic solar symbolisms in film, which I ended the Royal Arch of Enoch book with. I mean, I did the two National Treasure movies, Da Vinci Code. I did Being There with Peter Sellers, which is a solar movie. I mean, you got the whole Masonic, you know, quote, Illuminati crypt there at the end. The Johnny Depp movie, The Ninth Gate, has a lot of Kabbalistic Masonic themes in it.
Right.
These went into the Royal Arch of Enoch book, and really, you know, was sort of the kernel, you know, the acorn that grew cinema symbolism.
All right. And how long is the book for the Royal Arch of Enoch? Is it 700 pages?
Well, my book, the Royal Arch of Enoch book, is, I mean, the actual book of Enoch, I don't know how many pages it is.
Right,
I have it here. Oh, my book is, I want to say it's 690 pages in total. And that includes, that's, you know, the bibliography and, you know, everything. But I think it's 690 pages. I mean, it's a lot of information to digest.
All right. And you're currently working on two new ones.
Yes, sir. Royal Arch of Enoch is out. You can buy that right now in paperback and Kindle and ebook. And same with Cinema Symbolism. I am, as I speak to you right now, on March 19th, 2016, I am writing two books at once. I'm in the process of finishing Cinema Symbolism 2, which is coming along very nicely. I'd say that's about 85% done. This is a sequel to Cinema Symbolism. And I'm also writing my first work of fiction. Right now I'm concentrating on finishing Cinema Symbolism 2. I'm also writing my first work of fiction. I'd say that's about 60% done. That deals with a modern-day witch's coven. It deals with a lot of conspiracy theory. It's good stuff. I mean, all kind of witchcraft, demonism, all those great topics. So, no, right now I'm writing Cinema Symbolism 2, the sequel to Cinema Symbolism, and my first work of fiction, which is called A Pact with the Devil. I am anticipating both of those books to be out probably around the same time, late summer, early fall. Probably, to be brutally honest, probably more towards the fall at this point in time.
All right. You want to give us a little teaser or something that you're going to be covering in Cinema Symbolism 2?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. I mean, I'm going to be talking about some of the movies of Alan Moore. He is a cultist comic book writer. His movies have been turned into movies. I'm going to be breaking down From Hell, which has a lot of alchemical overtones, or undertones is probably better. The Watchmen movie, which has a lot of conspiracy in it. I call that a conspiracy smorgasbord. The V for Vendetta movie has a lot of Gnostic themes in it. I'm going to be talking about some David Lynch movies. I absolutely love his movies. Dune has a lot of monomythic themes in them. Very, very interesting symbolism of in Blue Velvet, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive. I will be breaking down all the Harry Potter movies. I will be talking about the Chronicle of Narnia movies. I mean, those are some of the films I would be talking about. What's some of the other ones? Oh, the Gangs in New York movies. The Gang in New York movie by Martin Scorsese has some very deep Catholic religious underpinnings in it. I'm going to be talking about some of the Western movies, Magnificent Seven, the spaghetti westerns of Sergio Leone, Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More, Good, the Bad, the Ugly. By and large, I would describe those movies as Christian Kabbalah. Good stuff. It's coming along very nicely. I'm really happy with the way it's coming out. Again, I'd say it's about 85% done, and the first work of fiction, I'd say right now, is about 60-65% done.
Okay, can you pick one of those Cinema Symbolism 2 movies and give us a little taste of it?
Yeah, I mean, let's see here. I mean, we have let's go to Harry Potter.
Okay.
Let's turn to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. There's an interesting symbolism going on in that one. This is the very first Harry Potter movie. We have the book is called The Philosopher's Stone, and the Philosopher's Stone is a substance used to transmute base metal into gold, symbolically ignorance to wisdom. And of course, all alchemy comes from the Emerald Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. So we get into the Hermes Trismegistus archetype in cinema. This is the wizard figure. I talk about this in Cinema Symbolism. We have Obi-Wan Kenobi. I mean, this is the old Greybeard character, right?
Right.
I mean, this is Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. This is Gandalf the Grey in Lord of the Rings. So who's the Hermes Trismegistus archetype in Harry Potter? Who else but Albus Dumbledore? So let's talk about Hermes Trismegistus in Sorcerer's Stone. You know, you go right to the beginning of this with Harry Potter and what's the guy's name? Hagrid. They go to the subterranean vault, right, to retrieve the Philosopher's Stone, the alchemical stone. You know, this is the Hermes Trismegistus stone. Albus Dumbledore is just the archetype of Hermes Trismegistus. And, of course, you know, we know that Hermes Trismegistus is critical from the conversation tonight, right? We know that Hermes Trismegistus is the godfather of Freemasonry. Hermes Trismegistus restores the literary pillar, the seven liberal arts and sciences pillar, in the royal arts ceremonial, in the philosophy. Hermes Trismegistus penetrates the vault, pronounces the name of God, and restores the seven liberal arts and sciences back to the mankind, or back to humanity. We know that in the ritual, the Royal Arch of Ritual is the 13th degree in the Scottish Rite. It's the 7th degree in the York Rite. So now we fast forward to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Harry Potter and Hagrid go into Gringotts Bank, and where do they go? They go to the subterranean vault. Whose vault are they going to? They're going to Hermes Trismegistus's, Albus Dumbledore, right, to retrieve the Philosopher's Stone. We have a vaulted archway above the vault. And what vault number belongs to Albus Dumbledore, Hermes Trismegistus? What's the number on his subterranean vault? What else but 713, the Royal Arch of Enoch? Because Dumbledore is Hermes Trismegistus, so of course his subterranean vault has to be numbered 713. That's a great one in the Harry Potter movies. And there's a little teaser for you. I will be breaking down all the Harry Potter movies. But again, it's numerological symbolism, archetypal symbolism, tarot embodiment. It's going to be a new slate of movies. I'm touching on some of the movies I talked about in the first book. I mean, I'm revisiting Black Swan. I'm revisiting the Ninth Gate movies, but it's going to be a whole slate of new movies. And it's coming out very nicely.
Awesome. Awesome. The Ninth Gate one, that's one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mine, too. We have in that, this is a movie that I originally broke down in Royal Arch of Enoch. You will find that analysis at the end of the Royal Arch of Enoch book. I have subsequently watched it and discovered more symbolism in it, so that's why I'm re-breaking it down in Cinema Symbolism. But you have this whole idea of the Ninth Gates. What this is... this is high degree Freemasonry also. This is very comparative. You have the Ninth Gates being the nine sephira of Hebrew Kabbalah, which leads to the 10th sephirot of Hebrew Kabbalah called Kether, and it's through unlocking this this gate that leads to this spiritual godhead called Ein Sof. This is known to the Gnostics as the monad. So the nine gates are the nine sephirot of Hebrew Kabbalah that lead to divine wisdom. You will find this in the Royal Arch of Enoch ceremonial, where the divine wisdom, the name of God, the emanation of divinity, is kept in this subterranean vault. It's concealed beneath nine archways, hence the nine gates that leads to divine wisdom. This is paralleled in high degree Freemasonry, where the divine Godhead, the name of God, is concealed beneath nine archways. This ties into Dante Alighieri. If you pay attention to the Ninth Gate movie, you will constantly see little busts of Dante Alighieri turning up. This is because this is the whole idea of the nine circles of hell that lead to Satan. He's at the very bottom of the nine circles of hell. But if you read this correctly, Dante's Inferno is actually reversed. It's a reversed of Catholic dogma, where Satan is divine light. So the whole idea is the nine circles of hell are leading to divine wisdom. If you actually you actually find this in Alighieri's story, where Alighieri and Virgil, when they're leaving hell, climb up Lucifer towards light, and leave Inferno behind to go to Purgatory. But the whole idea is this is symbolizing the reversal of the Catholic dogma that actually, you know, that the Inferno is at, you know, it symbolizes the whole Gnostic notion that the God of the Old and New Testament is the Gnostic Demiurge, and that this is why he's being punished in hell. But you know, you get beyond that, you will receive the light. So you also find this paralleled in the Faustus story of Mephistopheles, where Faustus steps on Mephistopheles in order to receive the light. You'll find this paralleled. So the Ninth Gate movie, the whole idea of the nine gates is Hebrew Kabbalah, it's the nine arches, and it's the nine circles of hell. I fully flesh this out in Cinema Symbolism too.
Nice. And what's the fictional book about?
Yeah, this is called A Pact with the Devil. This is a story, believe it or not, that I actually dreamt while I was asleep. I usually don't dream, and this dream, it's almost 3 years old at this point. The dream came to me in April of 2013, when I was in the height of writing Cinema Symbolism. I fell asleep and I just had this very lucid dream. The dream seemed to last like 8 or 9 hours. I woke up, I think, around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, went over to my desk and just started making notes on this story that had been shown, that I had envisioned. It starts out in Oxford University, which is my old stomping ground. It moves to London. It's about a modern day witches coven. There are Americans in it as well. It involves a conspiracy. I don't want to give too much of it away, but I really like the story. It's very dark. I was just on another show talking about this. When you're dealing with themes with witchcraft, what I didn't want to talk about, what the story I didn't want to write, was this idea of a witch's coven, you know, making little love potions or hexing the neighbor's, you know, dog or something like that. I had no interest in telling that story. What I was much more interested in was telling this sort of very dark story. And you get into this whole idea of witchcraft. You know, if you get into the whole medieval tradition of it, the pact with the demon, the pact with the devil, is really what was the witches were being prosecuted for. If you didn't have that element, you were basically dealing with nature worship or agrarian worship, you know, running around a cornfield at night under a full moon. But the whole idea of witchcraft being evil, you had to have this pact with a demon or a pact with the devil. And I was much more interested in this darker aspect of witchcraft, of forging a pact with a demon or the devil, and then tying into it the whole idea of witchcraft and the carnality of it, the sexuality of it, the erotic side of it. I had no interest in, you know, love potions or hexes or any of that. I was much more interested in the demonic sexual side of witchcraft. And it's a work of fiction. It's not real. All the characters are made up. There is one writer in the book, in the novel, who is a loose representation of me, but all the characters are made up. I mean, there's some public figures in it, of course, but all the main protagonists are, and antagonists are completely fictional, and it's coming along great. I really enjoy writing it. It's my first work of fiction, and I can't wait to get it out.
Is there going to be a lot of hidden symbolism in there?
Perhaps. We'll see. We'll see. I'll leave it at that.
All right. What's your website?
My website, if you're interested in my books and you want to find out more information about me, it's my name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. So my website is just that. It's www.robertwsullivan, the letter I, the letter V, Roman numeral IV.com. www.robertwsullivaniv.com. Links to buy Royal Arch of Enoch and Cinema Symbolism. You get paperback, you can get the ebooks, Amazon, Kindle. Links to all my social media, Twitter, Facebook fan pages. You can go to my YouTube channel, listen to other interviews I've done, watch some TV shows I've been on. It's very easy to navigate. Information about me, information about appearances such as this one that I'm going to be doing in the future. It's all right there, very easy to navigate. Links galore, www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
All right. Anything else people should know before we're done?
No, just thank you, Saria, for having me on Where Did the Road Go Tonight? I thought it was a tremendous show. I really appreciate the invite, and I look forward to returning with my new books when they come out. Hopefully you'll have me back on.
Of course I will.
I thought it was a great show tonight. Thank you again so much for having me on. I'm truly appreciative, and I look very much forward to returning with my new books.
All right. Well, thank you. And to take us out tonight, we're going to hear some Psyche Corporation appropriately off her CD, Crips and Codes. This is Whirring World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection?
To perfection.
5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission?
21, 34, 55, 89, 144.
Of the universe, ventricles and atriate, chambers number 1597,
and counting.
Can you hear?